the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will discuss how security threats present themselves often in a multitude of forms. And this week we look at the threat that mixes belief with nationalism. This threat is most obvious in its homeland where the movement was conceived, but its devotees have migrated to countries all over the world. When confronted by others within their communities, they respond with threats that by degrees become more sinister. We are talking about Hindutva nationalism, a right-wing movement which has its political epicenter in India. And in the United States, most recently, a network of universities had organized a virtual conference to discuss Hindutva's rise. The Washington Post reported this month the backlash was swift and staggering. It added, and I quote, "Nearly a million emails were sent to universities in protest. The virtual events website was attacked and forced offline. Organizers received death and rape threats." And the pro-Modi government media in India said that the event was Hindu-phobic and fostered hate against the Indian community. And in New Zealand, a country in the South Pacific which suffered the tragedy known as the March 15 white supremacist attacks that killed 51 Muslim people while they met for Friday prayer. There are concerns now emitting from within the vibrant Indian communities that Hindutva nationalism is growing. And as the news organisation in New Zealand, stuff.co.nz, reported this month, a professor at New Zealand's Massey University, Mohan Dutta, has spoken out against Hindutva's far-right messages. Professor Dutta has received hate messages relegating his concerns as promoting Hindu phobia. And again, as Stuff reported, Professor Dutta has received threats such as, "You bootlicker, you brown servant, if you were in India, you'd be burned." And also it added that we should do anything in our power to stop him. Those are the kind of threats that build up by degrees. So should we consider Hindutva as simply a right-wing nationalistic political movement with networks all over the world, or does it pose a serious and growing threat to security? And remember, if you are joining us live today, we can include your comments in this program, but first let's discuss all of this and more and cross to Paul Buchanan, who is waiting online. Good afternoon, Paul.
Kia ora, Selwyn, and thanks for that very good intro. I much appreciate it, and it's a very important topic that all relatively few media outlets have addressed, so thanks again, and where do you want to start?
Yeah, you're very welcome, and tanakwe, Paul, and ka pai for that. Okay, Matua, let's start with, I've done the backstory to it. Can you unpack all of this for us, Paul, as we deep dive into the issue?
Let me start with a more general framing, and then talk a little bit about Hindutva. We're talking about the dark side of globalization. Globalization in its present incarnation has involved the usual expansion of trade and cultural exchanges and that sort of thing, things that we've seen repeatedly throughout history. But now with the advent of modern telecommunications, transportation, and the like, what we also see is mass migrations of people from their countries of birth to other places, not necessarily refugees. I mean, people who are just moving around the world to pursue their economic fortunes and that sort of thing. And normally we think of this as a good thing, right? Immigration enriches, you know, countries and what have you. But in recent times, what we've seen is the exportation of and importation of ideologies from the mother country that oftentimes are inimical to the peaceful coexistence of heterogeneous groups in their new countries. And this is an example of it. Hindutva is to Hinduism what Salafism or Wahhabism is to Islam. It's an extreme right-wing hyper-nationalist ideology. It is not to be confused with mainstream Hinduism.
Exactly, because we've got in our country all around the world, you know, the wonderful kind of cultural expression of the Hindu faith and all faiths, you know, that brings such a wonderful vibrancy and a better experience in life for everybody, don't they? And I think you've put that really, really well, Paul. And sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to accentuate what you were saying there. And it would be interesting to see exactly what you're saying here in the comparisons of these various more extreme kind of vehicles of hate that can emit out any culture, including the white cultures.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there's multiple ironies here. I mean, what we see is Hindutva is an example of what is known as ethnic absolutism. And ethnic absolutism is the belief that a particular ethnic group, defined by their physical characteristics and their belief systems, have exclusive claim to a certain geographic territory. And Hindutva, which originated in the early 20th century in opposition to British rule, believes that India is a Hindu-only country. And they want to drive out all non-Hindu believers, to particularly Muslims, but also Christians, out of India. And it happens to be that the current leader of India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is, I won't say that he's Hindutva, but he is a right-wing Hindu nationalist. He's about as close as you can get without being part of that movement.
His own political party, for example, has open membership that is it celebrates Hindutva's impact there, doesn't it? Yeah.
Basically, Modi is a Hindu national populist. The Donald Trump, if you will, but with a serious ethnic absolutist approach. And he has history. When he was governor of Gujarat in the early 2000s, hundreds of thousands of Muslims were killed in ethnic violence, and he did nothing because most of the killing was Hindu on Muslim. So this guy is not a nice guy, and yes, he's the Prime Minister of India. But here's where things get interesting. What we're looking at is ethnic nationalist globalization, but its dark side. In the sense that now these diaspora communities are bringing their fights from home to their new countries. And then, and here's where Modi has a lot to answer for, they are encouraged, how could I put it, the groups, let's say Hindu groups in New Zealand and the United States, are encouraged by the Indian government discreetly and indirectly, so they can maintain plausible deniability and distance from them, to impose via intimidation a uniform view of the world from an Indian perspective. No dissenting voices, let's face it. There's a lot of moderate Hindus, there's a lot of non-Hindus, there's a lot of secular Indians, who would, in a democracy like New Zealand, should be able to speak their piece. And they're now being intimidated by their fellow Indians who espouse this extremist ideology. So I have major concerns that this is going to turn into acts of violence within the Indian community. Remember that one of the tenets of Hindutva is the purge of Muslims from India, and I can see that translating here. And there are indications in Europe that Hindutva adherents have approached right-wing white supremacists out of their common Islamophobic beliefs. You know, they're going to share info and that sort of thing. So my concern is multi-level, but one of them is that, as we've seen in the last decades, the intelligence and security authorities in liberal democracies, and I'll talk strictly about New Zealand here, have been playing catch up with terrorist threats. No one apparently saw 9/11 coming. Certainly here in New Zealand, no one did. And what were the major threat assessments on the 10th of September 2001 were immediately changed to, we got to watch out for homegrown jihadis, when there were none. Then they spent the next, 15 years worried about jihadis. And meanwhile, white supremacy was building up steam here in New Zealand. And even though the perpetrator of the Christchurch massacre was an Australian by birth, let's just say that some of his belief systems were nurtured here on the South Island of New Zealand. And yet that was missed entirely. So I'm hoping the authorities are on to the potential threat. Now, the problem here, again, from a liberal democratic point of view, and I'll leave you for the time being with this, is this Hindutva movement, is it's not a terrorist group. It's not like, I'd be willing to bet they have cells. Again, these guys are thugs. But they haven't organized, as of yet, into an identifiable group that the authorities could designate as a terrorist entity. They're more amorphous. And here's the final point. All of this is facilitated by modern telecommunications technologies, because most of the intimidation campaigns, again, with the tacit approval and support of governments like Modi's, are done via social media.
Yeah.
So it's a direct influence and intimidation campaign done on co-nationals by Indians with this extremist belief. And here's the rub. India is not the only place where this sort of, extremist nationalism or ethno-nationalism originates from. There are other countries with authoritarian-minded, if not outright authoritarian leaders, who are doing much of the same.
Yeah, and if we just go across here and see what the Washington Post is reporting on this, Paul, right in the heart of a country, obviously, that is coming to grips with a pretty dark and worrying immediate past under Donald Trump, a populist, and all of the problems that seem to have developed under this. But let's get back and scope on this issue. So this is the Washington Post. Its headline here is, "Under fire from Hindu nationalist groups, United States-based scholars of South Asia worry about academic freedom." So it's a broad headline there, but there's a paragraph here, and it's supporting some of the comments that you've made and analysis you've inputted into the program today, Paul. And it says, and I quote, "Hindu nationalism in India has been resurgent under Prime Minister Modi, who rose to power in 2014, has pursued an agenda that critics say threatens the rights of its minorities and compromises its democratic institutions. The result has been deepening polarization, not only in India, but also in diaspora communities," and I'd just add, around the world. So that's the Washington Post. If we just go across to in New Zealand, like we cited in the introduction, Paul, stuff.co.nz published a piece this month, October the 3rd, 2021, and the headline is "The Rise of Hindutva and Hate in Aotearoa, New Zealand's Indian Diaspora." And it comes down here and it details the divisions brewing within New Zealand, Aotearoa, New Zealand's Indian diaspora and its communities, highlighting parallels to the mindsets that preceded the March 15 Christchurch terror attacks. And it goes on there, and I stress that people are interested to have a read how this particular form of nationalism is spreading even to countries like New Zealand, as far flung in the South Pacific, but have significant, vibrant, wonderful Indian communities of Hindu faith, Muslim faith, Christian faiths, and every other faith that comes out of that wonderful breadbasket of ideas and culture, Paul. But let's get back to the security apparatus, Paul. We know that different groups Have been placed on the United Nations watch list relating to security concerns or terrorist group definitions are included in there. Is there any move, do you think, globally or amongst the multilateral bodies like that to start to raise concerns that this particular group that has its conception within the nationalistic movements of India expressing itself around the world, is it crossing that threshold or that tipping point towards where globally it can be considered something more of a of just a concern, but into a serious threat type regime?
Oh yeah, it's rapidly approaching that point. And I would imagine that the more far-sighted intelligence organizations already have their eyes on the broader movement worldwide. Let me point out the differences between this phenomena and other intervention influence operations that we've seen in the recent past. We've heard a lot, for example, about Chinese influence operations, including here in Aotearoa, whereby the Chinese government, through proxies, funnels money into various groups and organizations and political entities in order to influence their view of China more in accord with what the Chinese party wants them to believe. And so we understand that. What gets less press is the thuggery that mainland Chinese people in the diaspora levy on dissidents. Think of, for example, the fights at universities in New Zealand that broke out over Hong Kong, where groups of young Chinese men would storm in to, you know, peaceful demonstrations pro-Hong Kong and start intimidating and in some cases beating the peaceful protesters. This was even worse in Australia. So, you know, it's
on that point, what you're doing here is doing a comparative exercise, aren't you? You know, and saying, okay, what defines this particular group, this Hindutva, to other kind of concerns that you are seeing where there is nationalistic expression in other countries, mainly within the diaspora or the communities in far-flung countries like New Zealand. So you're picking up that the method of intimidation, the method of response to various groups' own community, if you like, where that community resists, there is a common ground there. There's a common type of tactic. How does it compare to other groups of concern around the world and also in countries that are perceived as rather peaceful and benign?
Yeah, let me flesh this out a little more, because what the dark side of the Chinese influence campaigns were trying to do is impose conformity within the Chinese diaspora to suppress dissenting voices. And Hindutva does exactly that within the Indian, without the heavy hand of the Modi government being visible. And I'll get back to that in a second. Let's think of another type of direct intervention campaign, the Russian fake news and electoral interference in the United States. But the Russians also dabbled in several European elections. You may recall that they fiddled with the French elections. They sowed disinformation all over the place. That's another example of what I would call, you know, again, direct influence or intervention operations, where you bypass the governments, you bypass actually the formal political system, and you go straight at the public. Now, in the case of Russian intervention, they weren't doing it to Russians abroad. Unfortunately for Russian dissidents abroad, they can be subject to assassination and things of a little more serious persuasion.
Novichok and the United Kingdom experience comes to mind.
Yeah, the poisonings are reserved for people who are considered traitors. In this case, spies who went on to the other side, who flipped and went to the other side. But let's just say there's a fair bit of intimidation within Russia diasporas as well. I'm told we have 20,000 Russians here in New Zealand, somewhat surprising to me. I would not be surprised if they are divided between pro-Putin and anti-Putin factions, and that the anti-Putin factions probably receive some unpleasant messaging from the pro-Putin factions about what can befall them if they step a little too much out of line.
My and just as is, a very quick aside before you finish the comparisons, sure, sure. Paul, I'll just add that under Donald Trump's presidency, there's reports that have been coming out from reputable news organisations like Al Jazeera, for example, where it's citing information, broadening, Yahoo News also was the source of that, where it's saying that Julian Assange was a potential target for CIA assassinations. Mm. You know, while this is slightly different, what we're talking about, like when you brought the Russian thing in, is sometimes there is direct intervention from state governments that are not using the communities or groups like this. So we're talking about issues of difference to the Hindutva type of operation here. So there's similarities in the way that the various factions use within the Chinese communities. There are similarities, obviously, with this Hindutva. But these other state, direct state actions are slightly different, aren't they?
They are indeed. I mean, I guess even if we move even further back, let's look at it this way. In the old days, you had government cultural transmission belts. Let's think, for example, of the Fulbright program out of the United States, or the various Lycée Francois that the French put around the world, where they're promoting U.S. or French culture. The Germans have this. This is all done on an official basis. It's designed to encourage positive relations between the countries involved. So it's all carrot, no stick. Then you have covert operations, direct intervention, various sharp power initiatives that are more coercive in nature, but usually they still are directed at others, not at co-nationals. What's different here is A, this sort of ethno-nationalist or ethno-political ideology driving this type of, you know, influence or intervention operation. B, that it's done against people originating from the mother country in question to impose conformity on them, not on others, on them. So there's a unified vision, that a public vision at least, that foreigners will see. And three, the use of social media as an indirect transmission belt. See, you can't see Modi's hand on the driving wheel behind Hindutva in New Zealand. Cannot see it, but it's there. It's there, and I say this because I just need to see his pronouncements about the activities of Hindutva worldwide. I only need to look back at his own behavior. I only need to look at his recent behavior with regards to Kashmir, and I can tell you that his hand is behind there somewhere. And in that measure, he reproduces a logic that the People's Republic of China have adopted. That is this whole idea of Jinping Xi thought, including wolf warrior thought, that is imposed on Chinese diasporas, both by a carrot approach, but also now with a lot of stick. And we've talked about the Russians. Think of it this way. In contrast, Israel promotes its view of the world. It promotes Zionism around the world. The trouble is, if you're a dissident Jew, if you're a Marxist Jew, they're not going to kill you. They're not going to send people to your house to beat you up. I mean, I'll give Israelis credit. When it comes to their own, that is Jews living abroad, who may disagree with them, they usually just let them go, or argue with them in op-eds and what have you.
And we saw the evidence of that in New Zealand. So yeah, we saw the evidence of what you're detailing there in New Zealand with when the refuseniks were down in New Zealand. Those are the groups of people, usually young, that refused to go into the Israel Defense Forces for whatever reasons. And they were joining various peace marches down here in New Zealand. They were left alone from what my understanding of it all was. So once again, that reinforces that view of what you're taking. There is a difference here.
Yeah, there is. And I think part of it is due to the erosion of international law, international norms in the last 10 or so years. And then again, I mean, I hate to beat this drum, but the pernicious influence of Donald Trump on global affairs. I mean, this guy has left a very dark stamp on the world that isn't going away anytime soon. And you can see it in the behavior of people like Modi. They're encouraged. Or let's think of Viktor Orban in Hungary, or Erdogan. We haven't even talked about Erdogan.
Yeah. Erdogan, let's do that. Let's dig deep into the.
All right.
This is the president of Turkey.
So the president of Turkey, increasingly authoritarian, well authoritarian at this point. He manages to win rigged elections and that sort of thing. He's now in the habit of having his people, his supporters, intimidate Turkish Kurds, Armenians, secular Turks abroad. Any Turk that doesn't support Erdogan, the Gulenists, of course, his main religious opposition comes from a guy in exile in the United States. Well, Erdogan can disavow any direct connection to the acts of violence that are meted out to, let's say, Turkish Kurd leaders in Europe. But it's uncanny the way people who are opposed to Erdogan find themselves on the sharp end of a stick someplace in exile or someplace, you know, far abroad. And so what I think is happening, again, all aided and abetted by modern technology, is that we're living in an era where the old sort of formal rules of statecraft, conceptions of sovereignty, I think that's what it reduces to. In the old days, you thought of sovereignty as being exactly that. You don't mess with the sovereign affairs of other states, even if it includes your immigrants. So, you know, if I get in trouble here in New Zealand, the United States government is, let's say I've committed a criminal act, okay, so I've done something clearly bad. I don't think the United States in the old days would have interfered in New Zealand's judicial process. Let's say if I was a Trump supporter and Trump was still in president, I'm not so sure that wouldn't, you know, might not have happened. My point being is with the erosion of concepts of sovereignty that are associated with this mass diffusion of social media telecommunications, you know, direct communications between people without the interference of governments, we see the rise of this ethno-nationalism or ethno-politics being transmitted from countries of origin, taking their fights to other countries and then resolving them there. The trouble for us in a liberal democracy like New Zealand, to say nothing of places like Canada, Australia, the United States, the UK, and then the democracy of Europe, is that if you bring your fights from the mother country, then you're disrupting the social stability of your adopted country. And quite frankly, no government can live comfortably with that.
So where to from here, Paul? Let's take and digest all of what you've been defining here. What do you think is the next step? Is it a situation, for example, where Hundutva can intensify for whatever reasons? And would it be intensified due to the need or requirements of its political supporters back in the mother country? Or are there other more local kind of trigger points that can occur? And on the back of that, I'll just put the question, how do you think the security agencies will move to get ahead of this issue that is clearly starting to get a lot of attention outside of the Indian communities?
Well, that actually is the good news. I think that the response has to be at least twofold. And again, I think we may be seeing this. It's interesting we're having this conversation. Maybe that weighed on my thought when we were preparing for today's show. They're in the process of creating here in New Zealand a center for basically the study of extremist violence and terrorism. And I'm interested in that center for various reasons. And part of it is to address the root causes, you know, how to act proactively rather than just reactively to acts of extremist violence and terrorism. And so I think, okay, what are we going to do with these Hindu-style guys here in New Zealand who have committed acts of violence, who have issued death threats? They seem to like to use rape as a threatening device. And I think, okay, the first thing you do, in, you do community outreach. And you go to the leaders of the Indian community, most of whom are Hindu, and you say, okay, you know, we simply cannot have this here. Okay, we cannot have it. Now, some of you are New Zealand citizens, and so, you know, we will deal with you as citizens if you move into acts of criminality. Some of you are not citizens, and you need to think about your immigration status when you start threatening people and doing things of that sort. We'll take a little closer look at you because, quite frankly, that doesn't pass the good character test, you know, which all of us had to undergo in order to become dual citizens. And so I wouldn't be subtle about it and say, you know, you're bringing your fight here, but we don't have any dog in that fight, okay? We're not, you know, this is not part of us. It's inimical to social cohesion, so knock it off and speak to the community leaders. On the other hand, diplomatically, I would engage in private diplomacy and call in the High Commissioner from India and say, you know, whether this is indirect or not, we cannot have Hindu extremists repeating their fights here in New Zealand. Okay, we cannot have that here. It's bad enough that it's occurring at home, but that's your sovereign decision. I mean, we will not interfere, even though we don't like some of what's going on back in India.
Do you think that would have an effect in a positive sense on this?
Well, it's done quietly and said, you know, this can jeopardize our you know, ongoing good relations. Now, pragmatists in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs will say, no, we're not doing that because we have a bilateral free trade agreement on the back burner with those guys. We have various security arrangements that are not quite visible to the public, but India is part of our networks. We don't want to jeopardize that. And I would say true, and that's why you've got to be very diplomatic. That's why you're being paid the big bucks. But you've got to tell them, it's basically this, don't bring your fights here, all right? It'd be as if me being nominally someone from the northeast of the United States came here and started picking fight with redneck Southerners who came down here because they like the Confederacy and Donald Trump. And we start having violent, you know, conflicts in New Zealand. I don't think the New Zealand authorities would appreciate that. The same
it's bad enough
here.
Where we have cultural kind of clashes like, you know, the Trump version of free speech, for example, that seem to wash over into the New Zealand thing. So, you know, we clearly in a country like New Zealand and having lived here for obviously born here and lived here for much of my life, there's a situation where things do show up very quickly. And when this issue came up, Paul, and you introduced me to this concerns, I then started to connect dots, and I've been hearing it from people of which I respect and engage with from the Indian communities that have been talking about this, but in more polite terms, perhaps, which is often the Indian way, isn't it? You know, so if we just have a look at what I'll do is Craig Burns over in Australia has made a comment here, and I'll just bring it up on screen. And he says, Paul, Imran Khan, that's the president of Pakistan, of course, and Pakistan and India, let's just say, do not enjoy civil relations much of the time diplomatically. So Imran Khan has been saying for a long time, this Hindu view is the major threat to peace in Asia, especially in the tensions over Kashmir. So that's an interesting kind of point. And notwithstanding that what we're talking about is the export of these divisions and clashes, and you've identified a number of other areas of concerns where, you know, diaspora seem to divide themselves and in some ways contain the problem for as long as they can before it starts spilling out into the wider populations by way of knowledge concerns, like in this case that we're having. If we take that diplomatic route, what I take from what you were saying, in part solution to the problem, is that that's basically laying down the rules of engagement, if we put it in that way, with other countries. It's a no surprises courtesy, perhaps on behalf of New Zealand government expressing to countries overseas that if this intensifies, if this continues, we're not having it, and this is what you're going to see. And then it needs, obviously, to be followed up with action in that sense, isn't it? Otherwise, it'll be disregarded as nonsense. So do you think that this problem within the Indian communities where practitioners of Hindutva are asserting their, as you put it, thuggery on peaceful living expressions of Hindu culture, of those expressing in Hindu culture, do you think that it has reached a point where this type of discussion, this type of solution is needed and indeed is taking place?
Oh, well, it certainly is. I mean, again, there are two problems here. I mean, there are many problems. And oh, by the way, thanks, Craig, for bringing that up. I'm not entirely sure that Hindu nationalism is the major threat to South Asia. For Khan, it clearly is. But I think we still need to remember that China's in that equation, too. And you know what one of the ironies is that India and China are great strategic rivals. And yet President Xi Jinping, and President Modi act increasingly alike when it comes to the treatment of ethnic minorities. I mean, there's the ironies. They're great rivals, but in a way, they're mirror images of each other when it comes to the treatment of minorities. Now, the Chinese, one might argue, are a little more genocidal, if that's the proper phrase. I know it's very much disputed, but you look at the actions of the Indians with regards to Kashmir. Again, as I said earlier, you look at Modi's track record, and they're not that far apart. So I think there are larger issues, but the key here is two things. The first is that Hindutva is ethnic absolutism at its worst. It wants ethnic cleansing. It believes that what is post-colonial India should be exclusively Hindu. It does not, you know, it does not accept the presence of minorities, ethno-religious minorities, in the Hindu homeland as they see it. So that is a racist ideology. The irony that it was born out of anti-colonialism. Again, this dates back to the early 20th century against the British. But it now rubs shoulders with right-wing white supremacists. So it's a racist ideology, and it's being promoted by an authoritarian leader or an authoritarian government, because Modi is Democrat in name only. This fellow is increasingly of the sort of Trumpian, Duterte, Bolsonaro, Urban, Erdogan persuasion. He uses elections to consolidate his power. So that combination of ethnic absolutism and authoritarian, you know, sort of power drives translated into ethno-nationalism in the diaspora is inimical to the internal affairs of the recipient countries. And that is the bottom line. These fights are interfering with the peace and tranquility of the host countries. And that is simply not acceptable, be it in Canada, be it, heck, you know, be it in Montenegro. Not that I want to bring up Serbian nationalists and all of that, but, you know, the point simply is,
perhaps we will in the future.
You brought fights that we have nothing to do with into our living rooms, you know, into our communities. And again, we have nothing to do with it, but more importantly, we completely and categorically reject ethnic absolutist ideologies of any sort, because that's inimical to consensus building and compromise that is required in heterogeneous demographics such as the one we have here. So I think we just make it an internal security issue. We tell the community leaders involved that they got to do their utmost to tamp it down. But that there could be coercive instruments used against them if they don't, and then make diplomatic overtures to the increasingly authoritarian-minded Modi government and say, you know, this is harmful to our relations, and although we're smaller than you, and we need you for many reasons, you actually need us too, because we're not the only country in which this is occurring. Your Anglophone allies are all seeing manifestations of this, and they don't like it either. And we've got common enemies. We have bigger fish to fry strategically. So how about we cut a deal? You keep it at home. We don't like it, but that's your sovereign right. And as long as it stays away from us and doesn't undermine us from within, again, we've got others doing some of the same things, then we can coexist peacefully.
On that point, Paul, thank you for your company, and thank you to those that have joined us in this live recording of this podcast, A View from Afar. And we look forward to your company again next week. That'll be around Thursday, midday, New Zealand time. And I think there's some daylight saving changes that are occurring in the United States pretty soon. So, but anyway, it'll be on a Wednesday evening, and we'll tighten up on the timeframes as we schedule.
Yeah, I think it'll be 6 p.m. next week.
It'll be 6 p.m. next week.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. We'll be ready to go. So we look forward to bringing the program back to you then. Until that time, take care and haere.